Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor, normally in Brussels, but today I'm in Dublin.
And I'm Sean Whelan, RTE's London correspondent, and I'm actually in Westminster.
And I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, RTE's deputy foreign editor, also in Dublin as usual. And each week, Brexit Republic, as you know, assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin. So we're going to go to our Brussels import first. Tony, here you are in Dublin for the day, tariff free. What has been going on in the minds of EU ambassadors in Brussels as they mull over the potential extension about to be offered, if it's being offered, to the United Kingdom?
Well, that's my starter for 10, Colm. Essentially, the European Union has been trying to figure out how best to respond to this extension request that Boris Johnson delivered through gritted teeth. As we know, last Saturday, he sent three letters altogether. One was an unsigned request for the extension. Another was a letter which basically said what a bad idea that was. And the third document apparently had large chunks of the Hillary Benn Act included in it. So the EU has had to decide on the basis of what is going on in Westminster, how to respond to this, and they are also trying to figure out how to do it in a way that is least damaging to the EU's positioning in all of this. So they're trying to take as neutral a stance as possible. So essentially, Boris Johnson has, as I say, through gritted teeth, asked for an extension until January the 31st. And that was, of course, an obligation of the Hillary Benn Act, which had to come in by Saturday night, the 19th of October. Now, in the meantime, the deal was done in Brussels the 17th of October, or the 18th rather, of October. And then he couldn't get it through the House of Commons because MPs hijacked the timetable. So that leaves the whole question of whether Brexit will be done at the end of this month or whether it will take longer to get the withdrawal agreement legislation over the line. And the EU has to suddenly figure out where on this sliding scale of possibilities it is best positioning itself. The ambassadors have been meeting. They're the EU 27 ambassadors. They essentially are the voice of the member states who ultimately will give their view on this. It's a decision that EU prime ministers and heads of governments will have to make, whether they have to come back to Brussels for a summit to do that or whether they can do it by what's called written procedure. That's one of the procedural issues that we have to figure out and get resolved. But I think overall, member states are A, fed up with what's been going on. They want some closure on this. They are absolutely insistent that the withdrawal agreement version 2.0 is the only show in town. There's not going to be any further offerings. And so they want to make sure this is done. So any extension that they offer will be designed to focus minds in Westminster to get them to concentrate on the narrowing options for the UK. And so for that reason, I think they will go for a January 31st extension. Whether there's a general election in between or not, I think that is where they will land. Ambassadors are going to meet again tomorrow. If you're listening to this on Saturday or Friday, then that's the meeting is on Friday, and they are due to give a fairly definitive view at that point. Now, if there is a disagreement among the different member states, and of course France tends historically to be quite a hard line on this question of an extension. Emmanuel Macron famously pushed for a very short extension back in April. He again seems to be unhappy with giving the UK another longish extension, even as far as January the 31st. So they've been talking, or there have been signals from Paris saying that they would only accept a short technical extension. But if there is a dissenting voice, then EU leaders are going to have to come to Brussels, perhaps on Monday, to sit down and work this out. But for the moment, it seems that the easiest and most neutral option for the EU is just to say yes to January the 31st. They might have some other language in there about the UK needing to have a decisive moment, perhaps a general election. I don't think they're going to talk about a second referendum, because clearly there just isn't the majority for that anymore in the House of Commons, if there ever was a majority. And so that's probably where things are going to land.
Sean, what Tony was saying there about there being no mood in Europe for further renegotiation of the withdrawal agreement, the DUP is not convinced by that. They want Boris Johnson to do as he said he would do before, and indeed succeeded in doing before, and go back to Brussels and seek a renegotiation of the withdrawal agreement. So talk us through what's been going on in Westminster and how the stance of the DUP has been crucial in all of this.
Well, it has been crucial. I mean, last week we spoke about how we were at the disadvantage of having to record it early in the week before the big events of Saturday had taken place. And I think we're in the same situation again this week. We've had a whole clutter of debates, a whole clutter of votes. A lot of things have become clarified, but a lot of things are still not clear. And we are awaiting, of course, that decision from the European Union, being cooked up essentially in cahoots with the British government, I suspect, to extend the Article 50 deadline. But let's have a quick canter through. Yes, last Saturday was supposed to be Super Saturday, the day that all of this got sorted, when there was supposed to be this meaningful vote, effectively the green light from the British Parliament for the agreement that Boris Johnson and the European Council had reached. That got scuppered by the Letwin Amendment that said it can't have a meaningful vote or a ratification of the treaty until all of the necessary legislation had been put in place. Then we had Monday, Stephen Barclay starting to come a cropper on the DUP questioning, picking away at some of this new disclosures that were coming out in all of the detail of this agreement. Of course, DUP votes had been critical on Saturday in securing the Letwin Amendment, and that was seen as the DUP getting payback against Boris Johnson for effectively shafting them at the European summit a few days previously. But since then, the DUP have come back for a bit more revenge on Tuesday in the two crucial votes there, the second stage of the withdrawal agreement bill, the agreement in principle to proceed with the legislation, which was won by Boris Johnson. First time he's won a vote since becoming Prime Minister, remarkably enough. First time also there's been a majority in the House of Commons for a form of Brexit. DUP didn't vote in favour of that. And they were also part of the opposition to the timetable motion that immediately followed on that on Tuesday evening, which was the government had intended to try and clear all stages of legislation in the House of Commons by Thursday night, which would have been tonight, and then have the House of Lords work on it over the weekends so that by early next week, Monday, maybe Tuesday, it would be ready to go back to the European Union for ratification by the European Parliament, and everything they hoped would be all tied up in a bow by the 31st of October. Doesn't look at all likely at this stage that that's going to happen. But again, the DUP, part of the opposition to that, the government losing by 14 votes there. And so we carry on. We are in this situation of waiting for the Benn Act to be applied. We know the request has gone from the government, signed or unsigned, whatever. The European Council have taken it on board. They are in the process, as Tony was saying, of sorting out an extension for something to happen. And whether that something is to enable the British Parliament to carry on sitting, carry on doing its legislative work and working through this very complex, very interesting bill, the withdrawal agreement bill, and doing the normal legislative process and then leaving the European Union at some stage between now and Christmas, or whether they're going to say, you've got just to hang on into the bitter end and wait until January 31st. We'll just have to wait and see on that one, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Sean, it's very interesting, this whole scrap over when to have the election. I think all the parties are trying to position themselves for maximum advantage. But of course, I think it's very important to remember that if the extension is indeed until the 31st of January, then only within a matter of months is the new Prime Minister, let's say it's Boris Johnson, going to be grappling with the question of, do they look for an extension to the transition? Now, the transition period lasts until the end of December 2020, which at the time was a fairly decent cushion for businesses and individuals and citizens, if we walk it back to when Theresa May negotiated the treaty back in November of last year. The transition was there to avoid a cliff edge for people, so that if the free trade agreement wasn't done quickly, then there would be this transition period where nothing would change. All of the trading and commercial links between the UK and the EU would stay as they are, the standstill transition. But of course, because Theresa May was defenestrated, and we've had the Tory leadership race, and we've had a new Prime Minister, and we've had new negotiations, the transition has steadily been chipped away. That means that if they want to extend the transition, then they have to decide by July of next year, July 2020, which is only a few months really after a new government would get into place. And of course, the transition is intimately linked with the question of money. The 39 billion or so that Britain is liable for is tied to that date of the end of 2020. So if they seek a longer transition, perhaps a two-year transition, then they're automatically going to be haggling over money. So for Boris Johnson to be taking up the reins of his brand new mandate with a thumping majority, then he's going to be straight into the weeds of trying to negotiate with the EU how much money Britain has to spend or has to pay to the EU for 2 years, and not be at the table, not be making any of these rules. They will be completely a rule taker. The whole question of vassalage will come back into the debate. So that may guide Boris Johnson and his team as to when they go for the election. And that might be why we have an election sooner, in other words, on this side of Christmas rather than later.
Do they go into an election without having formally Brexited, formally left the European Union, in which case there's a scrap between the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, the Liberal Democrats and the Brexit Party, who will be looking to keep the feet to the flames of Brexit by the Prime Minister, and also against any other backsliding from any of the other parties. So they will still be in it. I mean, there's a real sense of the wind having come out of the sails of the Brexit Party over the past week or so, when this agreement did get into place, and particularly after that vote in the Commons on Tuesday night to accept the general principles of the withdrawal agreement bill. You could see the landing zone, as it were, starting to rush up in the field of view of everybody, and the Brexit Party becoming considerably less significant as a force. But if they do decide to stick around for an election, they could be problematic for the Conservatives in particular, but also possibly for the Labour Party. On the other hand, if Brexit is done, it becomes a straight up business as usual type fight between the Conservatives and the Labour Party, both of whom are really keen, if not desperate, to talk about anything except Brexit and try and sell a bunch of other messages. The Conservatives, as we know, talking about spending on police and law and order and clamping down on immigration and all that sort of thing. The Labour Party having a go at them about all of the cutbacks that have happened in Britain over the past several years and the social consequences of all of that. And the fact that the Conservatives have been in power for quite a long time now might count against them. But also, you've got the big factor in the election, the Corbyn question, and how well he is going to play with the elector. So a lot of moving parts in considering when the election might be, and also calendar considerations as well. As far as we know, if they don't call an election today, effectively they've missed their slot for a November election. Then the first available option in December that some people have looked at has been the 4th of December. But of course, London is playing host to a NATO summit on the 3rd and 4th of December, in which you'll have all of the NATO heads, including President Trump, of course, in town, and you'd wonder whether he'd be able to resist an electoral appeal on the eve of an election or the day of an election. So, and you know, for logistical reasons, there's just no earthly way you could have a NATO summit going on and a general election at the same time. So that probably rules that day out. And then they've been briefed, apparently, that after the 12th of December, it becomes more or less impossible to hold elections in Britain because a lot of the school halls are going to be pressed into use for, well, things that school halls were built for, particularly at that time of year, namely nativity plays. It's not going to happen. And even things like public address equipment, very hard to get their hands on that because a lot of it has been pre-booked for the Christmas party scene. So there the opportunities to hold an election this side of Christmas getting really narrowed by those practical considerations, calendar considerations, of course, the EU considerations as well. And then, of course, as we know, politicians hate post-Christmas elections as well, because post-Christmas, that's when the credit card bills for Christmas start landing on the doorsteps. It's cold, it's miserable, and nobody likes going out canvassing, and nobody likes opening their doors to politicians at that time of year either. So you never know. They might even get an extra piece of time out of the European Union. Who knows? Maybe it could be March 29th again. That's got a ring to it, hasn't it?
One of the things, Sean, the withdrawal agreement bill was pulled from further debate, and there seems to be a concern or a fear, at least among some quarters in Downing Street, that if an extension, a long extension, is granted by the EU, then it goes back into the Commons. The scrutiny leads to further amendments. The withdrawal agreement bill begins to fall apart. Momentum is lost. And you're in a situation where, as you say, this could be kicked out longer. Is there any sense now that it's less doable than heretofore? And does this put Boris Johnson back in the frame of being lame duck like Theresa May was?
I don't think he's back in the Theresa May category, not yet anyway. Yes, there's always a risk when you have an agreement like this that if you bring it back and give a lot of time to MPs to debate it, they will take the time and they will find the things in it that they don't like. And it's a risk with any kind of an agreement that comes back and the implementing legislation on it. And we had a foretaste of that already because Stephen Bartley, as I mentioned, was in a House of Lords committee on Monday, made a mistake, then had to correct himself and say that, in fact, consignments of goods coming out of Northern Ireland will be subject to filling in a particular type of form, an exit summary declaration. It's not a full customs declaration, but it's a new bit of paperwork that will only affect goods going from Northern Ireland into Great Britain. That, of course, was fastened on by the Democratic Unionist Party, saying you have promised us all along that we would not have any different regime to the rest of the United Kingdom. And yet here you are admitting that there's going to be this extra bit of paperwork, probably an extra cost, certainly an extra time cost, certainly extra red tape and bureaucracy that's going to have to be gone through.
They're not really sure the technology could look after that, no?
It'll look after it to quite an extent, but it's still a piece of, you know, even if the form is an electronic form, somebody's still going to have to fill it in. And yeah, they can cut and paste up for a lot of this stuff, presumably, but it still has to be accurate and it still has to be all accounted for. And it's just, you know, one more little thing, perhaps more symbolically problematic than practically problematic, but it's still there. And that has led to the DUP getting more and more aggressive. Barclay, again, was having a really torrid time in the main chamber today. During questions, the DUP and a couple of other members, Labour, are starting to join in this particular attack because, hey, it's an attack on the government of separation at different differences between the regimes that would apply in Northern Ireland and elsewhere in Great Britain. And then when you start to dig down further and further, Clause 21 is something that Nigel Dodds in particular has been talking about. And this is the enabling powers for the Irish Protocol. This is how the Withdrawal Agreement Bill would put the protocol into effect. And the way they do that is to give very strong powers, described as Henry VIII powers, to ministers to be able to introduce secondary legislation that would have the effect of legislation passed by the House of Commons. So really, really strong powers to do all kinds of things, including amending the Withdrawal Agreement Act itself to implement this particular protocol. So they are getting quite concerned about that. And it just opens up, as you say, a huge avenue of attack, of debate, of delay, and the possibility of unwinding things. The more that they dig into it, the more they find there's things that they don't like and can build, try and build up a head of steam amongst other members in the House. And then you do start to get into the long grass.
Yeah, and I think what has really been fueling this sense of betrayal among the DUP was they thought they were covered by the joint report, which, remember, goes back to 2017, December 2017, which is the political commitment which initially gave rise to the backstop. And you remember there was the backstop paragraph itself, paragraph 49, the DUP who saw the detail of that and freaked out and said they're never going to accept that. And then everybody had to come back to Brussels and they negotiated paragraph 50, which basically spelled out that there would be no hindrance to trade between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. It would be unfettered access. But of course, now when you look at this, it is fettered access in a sense, because, as you say, declarations will have to be made. Now, as I understand it, a lot of these requirements are simply reflecting WTO rules, because if the UK wants to strike a trade agreement with a third country, then that third country wants to make sure that the privileged access that UK goods come into that third country are UK goods. They haven't come from somewhere else. They haven't come from the EU. They haven't come from China. So that's why they are required to have these controls, or at least an idea of what is coming into Great Britain. And there are also a list of requirements for dangerous goods or endangered species and so on. So that's really where things are at there.
Okay. Presumably those regulations would also apply, Tony, to any free ports that might be established in Britain. There's been talk about the Teesside being designated as a free port to facilitate the car industry, which is imports heavily most of the components it uses and exports most of its production back into the European Union. But if something crosses from a free port into the rest of the UK, there would presumably be these kind of bits of bureaucracy required there as well. And that, you know, might ease the political concerns in Northern Ireland if that were to come about. But if Northern Ireland is just on its own, you can see how it would certainly be a niggle, something that would rankle with them. And indeed, something that Sammy Wilson raised about the costs last week in committee, saying it was estimated at about $500 million a year as additional paperwork costs on Northern Ireland business, and asking, was this going to be compensated by the British government?
Remarks by Simon Coveney earlier at the Belfast Chamber of Commerce, unlikely to reassure the DUP on that. He was saying that businesses from south of the border could locate north of the border to avail of the in-between status of Northern Ireland. But heretofore, the voices of the farming and business community haven't persuaded the DUP to back options that are close to the status quo, or indeed, just to go back to why we are having a discussion at all about a new withdrawal agreement bill coming out. We have to go back to Thornton Manor and the meeting between Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and Prime Minister Boris Johnson. And Tony, you have a few more insights into maybe what went on behind those doors.
Yeah, I mean, this was the big breakthrough, as we know, and a lot of people were amazed that suddenly, amid such pessimism and disconnect between the British and EU sides on what Boris Johnson had planned, and the idea that he seemed to insist on a customs border on the island of Ireland that was going to be mitigated by technology and so on. So, you know, the obviously something big happened at Thornton Manor. We know that the two men talked together for 90 minutes. But it turns out that going into that meeting, the Irish government were really quite nervous because all the kind of traffic and impetus from London seemed to be heading in a much more negative direction, because remember, at the beginning of that week, you had the famous text message to James Forsyth in The Spectator, which everyone assumes came from Dominic Cummings, that the bete noire, if you like, of Remainers and the Liberal elite in London, who seems to have Boris Johnson's ear. And then you had the briefing about the phone call between Boris Johnson and Angela Merkel, where it was briefed out of number 10 Downing Street that she demanded that Northern Ireland stay in the customs union. And there was a depiction of a very robust and, you know, very direct demands from Angela Merkel, which most people were saying were completely out of character. So going into that meeting, the Irish government were really thinking that Boris Johnson was heading in a completely different direction. But they went in to the to a room off the main, one of the main reception areas. This is this 19th century Elizabethan style manor that's often used for wedding receptions. It's you know, oak panelled and so on, portraits hung on the walls. But something happened within that 90 minutes, and initially the two teams were anticipating that you'd only get an outline agreement between the two men, and that the two sets of negotiators then, or the officials, would then have another couple of hours together while the two men went off in their different directions home. And that the two teams would then have to try and put a bit of flesh on the bones. But actually, when they they were summoned into the room after 90 minutes, and they had what's called the download. So the two main officials on both sides were given an idea of what they discussed, and they had made such strides that the meeting of officials afterwards wasn't deemed necessary. And they also issued this joint statement saying that they could see a pathway to an agreement, and nobody was anticipating that. But the big bargain, which of course now we know about, is that Boris Johnson accepted that there couldn't be a customs border on the island of Ireland. It would have to be shifted to the Irish Sea. And Leo Varadkar accepted that there would have to be some kind of consent mechanism or oversight mechanism for Stormont. And once those two big concessions were made, that those big strides were made by both sides, then that opened up a lot of space for more technical type compromises. So in the end, that's why you do have this customs board in the Irish Sea. But a lot of the typical friction of a customs border, all the declarations, the checks, the controls that we've been talking about, they're going to try and find ways to mitigate those as far as possible. And that'll be something that'll be carried out by this joint committee, which the withdrawal agreement sets up, of officials from both the UK and the EU. But critically, the EU will have a veto on how these schedules of stuff that gets tariff-free access or gets check or control-free access to Northern Ireland from Great Britain, how that whole thing will work. But it will go down, I think, in history as the decisive moment in Brexit, where two men in a room together were able to take a big step towards each other. And this, I guess, is just the pure politics of it.
Sean, looking ahead to the upcoming week as we wrap up here, what's coming up on your side of the fence?
Well, it all depends on what happens with this request to the European Union for more time. The official order of business in the House of Commons next week is incredibly light. It includes speeches in praise of the chaplain of the Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow. That's scheduled for next Thursday. That's also the same day he is meant to step down from office. So I'm sure that's going to be a love fest for Mr. Bercow. There's nothing about Brexit in the running order at all. They've got a full day debate on Grenfell Tower. There's expected to be a report published into that tragedy. But other than that, really nothing Brexit related officially there. It all just depends on what agreement is reached with the European Union about the extension of time. And once that falls into place, then everything else will fall into place, whether they carry on in the Parliament, working their way through the legislation, whether they go into proper committee sessions and start taking evidence from people and getting really in depth about how these bills are, or this bill is supposed to work, in particular how these Henry VIII powers that are supposed to apply, because it's through those Henry VIII powers that they will implement a consent mechanism for Northern Ireland. They haven't figured that one out yet. They're going to figure something out, and then a minister gets to implement it without the normal legislation following through. All of that sort of detail has to be worked through at some stage. Whether they go ahead in that, or whether we see Boris Johnson trying to get, for the third time, the House to agree to a two-thirds majority to go off and have a general election remains to be seen. It's all up in the air, I'm afraid. I'd love to give you a big list of diary items for next week, but really we're just waiting. Limbo is a word that's been thrown around in the House of Commons this week. Purgatory is another version of it. But yeah, we don't know what's happening, basically.
Brussels, Tony?
Yeah, Brussels. Well, we're waiting to hear whether or when the EU will decide on what kind of extension to grant to the UK. As I was saying earlier, if there is a dissenting voice or a number of dissenting voices, then they are going to have to come back to the to Brussels to sit down and have a quick emergency summit, possibly Monday. But again, everything depends on what the verdict is from member states. And beyond that, there's not a huge amount happening because it's running into school holidays and so on. But everything hinges now on this decision.
OK, that's it for another edition of Brexit Republic. From me, Colm O'Mungain here in Dublin.
From me, Sean Whelan here in London.
And from me, Tony Connolly, also in Dublin. Thanks for listening.